an oil spill would pollute the drinking water of about a million people. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 93 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, it's 93 degrees as well and also partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The time now is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi coming up.
And brothers, welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio. I'm your host, Milton Alamadi. Today, our guest is Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussain. We've had him on this show on a number of occasions to discuss Pan-African issues. Today, we will be tackling Tigray, but there's another area that I want us to also look at for a little bit, and this is South Africa, with the news development of former President Jacob Zuma being sentenced to a 15-month prison term. But first of all, welcome to Black Star News Show, Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussain.
Thank you for inviting me.
Excellent, excellent. Why don't we get straight into it? Jacob Zuma, 15-month sentence for contempt of court. He had been undergoing a long, stretched-out corruption trial. And now he says that he won't be making any more appearances because the court is biased against him. The people that conducted the investigation were biased against him. He says this is a political witch hunt. What do you say, comrade?
At the outset, I would say it's laughable. I think no one is above the law. As much as he is a popular figure within the ANC during the time of the struggle, his subsequent actions have not been, that flattering, actually, in many ways. And that's what he's being accused of, corruption and so on. But the fact that he failed to appear to the when he was summoned to court and was really rubbing his nose at the court, and no one should be above the law. I think South Africa should be commended for having a wonderful constitution and a court judicial system that it's enforcing it even on a former president.
Well, this certainly will be a test of that constitution, will it not? I mean, some of his supporters are saying he should defy this. In fact, I read somewhere that they said they would form a human wall to surround his home to prevent him from being arrested.
That's very unfortunate. Like I said, he's a very popular figure. He's a sort of a populist in many ways, and folks in his ways, and of course he has a history of being a fighter for the liberation of South Africa from the apartheid system. So he does have a history, but no one, not even a hero like that from those days. Should be above the law. No one should be given a carte blanche to do whatever he or she wants. That's outside the law. The law is the law.
And now what do you say when he says former criminals and apartheid killers like de Klerk were never treated that way?
I mean... one can argue that he may have a little bit of a point, but then that was arrived at negotiations through Truth and Reconciliation to forgive but not to forget. I mean, there were so many things. Actually, we are all conflicted about that, that many of the perpetrators of the crimes against really humanity in many ways by the apartheid regime were able to confess and go scot-free. But that was something
the,
that...
The killers of Steve Biko.
Yeah, exactly. So there is...
The killers of Sobukwe and all those heroes.
Absolutely.
Those
absolutely.
Who terrorized Winnie Mandela for years. Those
yes.
who committed the Soweto massacre, the Sharpeville massacre.
The Sharpeville massacre, yes.
But you're saying that that is a bed that they helped make and they should now sleep on that bed in terms of the negotiated resolution of the apartheid era?
Not too many of us were happy with that, but I think that whole Truth and Reconciliation process, for whatever it's worth, was arrived at, so that the new South Africa, where it could be multiracial, can live in harmony and so on. None of us are happy about the way that those criminals really were able to account for their activities during the apartheid regime. There is a reckoning at some point that may have to be really faced with that. You're making a good point.
And they still own the land. More than 70% of the land still owned by the less than 8% population of European South Africans.
That's the more important point for me, frankly, that while it gave political constitutional rights to the majority population, I think the economic relations have not changed. The bulk of the country's economy is still in the hands of the minority whites, and in fact, South Africa may be looking down the road at some point that the land issue will erupt, and there are many who are calling for Zimbabwe-like
expropriation.
Yeah, exactly. So. That is yet to be resolved because it's not resolved.
I guess that is the battle of the generation of Julius Malema and the economic freedom fighters, I guess.
Exactly. They have to carry on the fight. I think the older generation has brought the political rights to the Africans, from now on, Malema and even the younger ones than him have to fight for economic peace and justice.
Okay, so now one final point on this particular issue with Zuma. You pointed out the South African Constitution, and this is a serious test. And when I think of that, I'm reminded that many of these African countries had commendable constitutions in the 1960s before some of them, their leaders, started messing around with the constitution. And I'm thinking South Africa ought to be careful with that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this are you talking about the implementation?
In terms of nobody should be above the Constitution.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I think the South African Constitution is the law of the land at the moment and has to be respected. No one is above the Constitution. No one is above the law. And the idea of amending the Constitution as a certain leader or you know dictator seems fit to suit his own interests should be really fought, you know, strongly and resisted. So, you know, no country can be governed without a constitution, and no country can survive ignoring or for that matter tinkering with the constitution for a specific purpose for one's own interests.
Yeah, I mean there are many examples in
a lot of them. Yeah,
in my favorite Uganda, as you know, the dictator 35 years. When he did not like the term limits on the constitution, he bullied his parliament into removing that.
Yeah.
And then there was one final obstacle, an age limit of 75. And when he was interviewed, 2 years before the last recent election that he stole in January, that you'll be older than 75 by then, would you run? And he said, no, you would not, because above the age of 75, there's some diminution in the intellectual acuity, so that he would not run. But obviously, this guy's a serial liar. He had the age limit removed. And man, he ran. He lost, but he declared himself president. So, I think constitution is critical. And many African countries still look up to South Africa sort of as a beacon of hope. And it would be sad if Zuma thinks he should prevail over the law of the land.
I agree with you 100%. I think, I agree that many, actually the whole African continent, the people of Africa, not necessarily governments, are watching carefully, you know, how this eventually, gets worked out, because it's like you said, you know, that South Africa is a beacon of hope, and we cannot allow South Africa to, degenerate into some of these dictatorships that have played with the constitution. As you mentioned, the case of Museveni and so on.
Yeah. And on a final note, I heard that, you know, many years ago, Nelson Mandela was actually very concerned about Jacob Zuma's itchy fingers. And he actually instructed the party to make available more than $1 million at his disposal. This is long before he became president, Zuma, in the hope that once he had been set up with that extra money, he would have less temptations to have sticky fingers. Obviously, that did not seem to have worked.
That was wishful thinking. I think if you have sticky fingers, I will always have those fingers. You know, I mean, that's what happened, and the courts of South Africa, to its credit, really went all out against a former president, a popular one at that within the ANC ranks, and still it just enforced the law. So, I do agree. The supremacy of the law should be important.
Yeah, we have to start, stop elevating these individuals as sort of deities, you know. And I hope this sends a message to other African countries where judges should now be more emboldened, the judiciary, where citizens also should become much more emboldened and make it clear to leaders that think they are above the law, that if an important country like South Africa can enforce the law, there's no reason why other African countries should not do the same. So listeners, you are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio, Black Star News Show. I'm your host, Milton Ali Mahdi. This is the point in the show where I remind you, listeners, that it is listeners like you that keep us going and delivering these types of programs, these types of interviews focusing on our beloved Africa, the motherland. And we can do it only with your support. So this is when I remind you to dig deep and support WBAI. You can do so by calling 212-209-2950. Any generous contribution will be put to good use. You can even support us a little more by adopting one of the shows as a buddy. And I hope Black Star News Show is one of your favorite shows, in which case, as a buddy, the money would be taken out on a monthly basis from your credit or debit card. And you can do so by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBAI.org. Now, back to our guests, Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussain. All right, so why don't we switch to another area of concern before we tackle the new developments in Tigray, and that is in the Sudan. In Sudan, last week, and we, for listeners that sometimes get confused, there's Sudan, and then there's a separate country of South Sudan.
Yes.
South Sudan with Juba as the capital. And today we're talking about Sudan with Khartoum as the capital.
Yes.
So in Sudan, Khartoum, there were protests last week over the country's recent deal of with the IMF. I think it's for a $2 billion loan. And people are protesting because of the austerity measures that have been are supposed to be imposed as part of this loan agreement. And I personally wholeheartedly support that kind of protest. I hope we see it in other African countries. The IMF just loaned Uganda as well on January the 28th, $1 billion. Purportedly to shore up the economy and to help fight the COVID pandemic. And it's preposterous because last year, the IMF loaned Uganda $491 million and the World Bank $300 million. And that was also purportedly to help fight the pandemic and provide relief to the citizens. And that money was diverted or embezzled by the corrupt military regime of Yoweri Museveni. And yet, Uganda is the beneficiary of another $1 billion loan just about a week ago. So I support what is going on in the Sudan, and I hope the IMF really pays attention this time. And I want to get your thoughts on Sudan specifically, but generally, the IMF and its relations with Africa generally.
I think with Africa particularly, and yes, with most developing countries in general, I think one has to go back to the times when we had what we called structural adjustment.
Adjustment, right.
The point being that many of these developing countries were actually discouraged from investing in the absolutely necessary educational, health, and other social,
human resources,
human development programs. And it's always been, we've seen that happen in Argentina, in Ecuador, and and so on. People have been protesting because of the decrease of subsidies that these governments had, for example, for bread to be affordable. That was, in fact, at the beginning of the revolution in Egypt also, the spark, in fact.
Right.
So I'm not surprised that this is happening in the Sudan. In Sudan, they are protesting because they have had already 2 to 3 years of constant protest and watching very carefully how the government is managing the country. It's a country in transition. It's a hybrid military and civilian government, but it's always the people, grassroots organizations that have been, you know, really keeping this revolution, trying to keep it alive. The Hamdok government, arrived at in exchange for a loan to cut some of the subsidies that citizens had. I think it might have been, if I'm not mistaken, was it about on fuel, I think?
On fuel, yes, yeah. But that affects everything else as well. Food.
Exactly.
So these are
human needs are being sacrificed in order to get, a loan as that, and it's not something. It's not even a gift. It's a loan. You still have to pay it back, at interest that eventually bankrupts you. So that's what the protest is. I think they are trying to keep the Sudanese revolution alive. Unfortunately, the military is.
You mean the grassroots folks are trying to keep the revolution alive?
Exactly. So.
Let me ask you that question specifically. Sudan has always had that history of grassroots, the professional class, the trades unions, since the 1960s.
In
fact, have succeeded in ousting military regimes, which is unique compared to many African countries.
Yes. They got rid of Aboud, the first military dictator.
Correct.
Then they got rid of Nimeiri.
Correct.
You may remember. So it's a revolution.
And ultimately got rid of Bashir as well.
Bashir as well, of course, the ultimate one. And so it was the professional class, by the way, allied with the. This is unique in Sudan. You don't see it in many other countries. The professional class, lawyers, doctors, allied with the trade unions and students.
It's amazing. It's such a pity that in so many other African countries, the professional class always sits on the fence and sides with the regime and takes some banknotes and some positions and abandon the masses.
That's what happens. But this one is, in the Sudan, is unique. And that has been the case, not only with Bashir, but even earlier, it was that kind of protest. They always were part of that protest movement. The trade unions are active. In fact, at one time, Sudan has the largest communist party
on the continent.
And some of the top, really, Marxist, scholars among them. So Sudan is unique in that regard.
Yeah, I think there's certainly many lessons to be learned by other African countries in terms of how the professional classes can really form strong alliance with the common grassroots folks and the trade unions. Because otherwise, I think our beloved continent is going to continue facing these challenges for quite a long time.
I agree. I do agree with you.
Yeah, I think we can't continue with this.
No, I just want to say the IMF essentially was established to really stabilize the economy for the advanced capitalist countries at the time of the end of Second World War.
Correct.
So, it was the purpose is still there. I mean, it was, the World Bank, which used to be International Bank for Reconstruction and Development
at
the time, This was really mostly European countries, the U.S. being the main,
shareholder.
All the financial institutions pegged to the dollar and so on. So, it's really of the Western developed countries' creation and serves that purpose.
Right. And in the case of Africa, it's transformed itself as sort of an enforcer of neo-colonial relations, really.
Exactly. So is this, this heavy loan burden and the heavy interest that's being levied against those debts, is what's keeping Africa in many ways, especially the structural adjustment set back many countries decades.
Listeners that are interested in these issues, we've had a number of protests by Ugandan organizations in front of the IMF and World Bank offices. And, for updates, you can check blackstarnews.com. And certainly before the summer is over, we plan to have a few more. And obviously, we welcome our American sisters and brothers to join us in these protests against these neo-colonial institutions. So why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we will tackle Tigray with our guest. The second half hour of Black Star News Show. Listeners, I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. And today our guest is Dr. Mohamed Nourissain, retired medical doctor, Ethiopian born, very knowledgeable on the African continent generally. And today, in the second half hour, we're going to be focusing now on developments in Tigray. Since the November launch of the war, or we could say invasion by the federal government troops into the Tigray region, on the orders of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Abiy Ahmed had claimed that this was going to be a short war. It would be over very quickly. That has not been the case. And on this show, we've discussed the crises in terms of the hunger, in terms of the mass killings of civilians, in terms of the mass rapes of women and mass executions. We've discussed it in a number of episodes of Black Star News Show with our guest, Dr. Mohamed. So today we want to discuss recent developments. Was it last week that the capital of Tigray, Mekele, reportedly fell to the control of the rebels? Can you give us an update from that point, Dr. Mohamed?
Thank you, Milton. I think the introduction you gave was correct, except that he didn't call it a war. He called it a law enforcement operation, like a police operation to bring, capture the what he called criminal elements within the
Very interesting. Plan. Police enforcement with Air Force bombings. Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. So that police operation turned out to be you know, the bulk of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and some 20 divisions, half mechanized, of the Eritrean Defense Forces, and bolstered by the militia from the adjoining Amhara region, tens of thousands of troops, all fighting about bringing this so-called police operation to Tigray. In any case, as you said, you know, he declared the war over once Mekele fell. And the reason that he felt that way was the Tigray Defense Forces at the time were actually, you know, had a setback because of the United Arab Emirates drones that destroyed much of their heavy weaponry. But then they went
okay,
into...
Okay, so drones being flown on behalf of the National Army.
Ethiopia and Eritrean invading troops.
And who controlled those drones? Where was it being flown out of?
They were flying out of their base in Eritrea and flown by the United Arab Emirates.
I see. So they were supporting them with the drone. And those drones, were those armed drones with missiles or...?
Well, we don't know for sure, but
were they providing intelligence and aerial?
No, they were actually involved in the bombardment.
Oh, so they were armed. Okay.
Yeah. They were neutralizing. They were on a bombing mission.
Understood. You
know. Yes. Not reconnaissance.
Okay. So are you saying element has now ended, and is that what changed the tide, or?
Yeah, they did the most damage with the Tigrayan Defense Force in the beginning. But once that happened, the Tigrayan forces went into a guerrilla mode, and they
abandoned the city.
Yeah, and okay. So that's then they went to the mountains, and then the you know, thousands and thousands of Tigrayans flocked to the Tigray Defense Forces to join them. They were actually getting more recruits than they could handle. So they were able to train and equip this, in a short time and turn it into a formidable army. And it was during, maybe about a month ago, they went into the offensive mode and initially liberated quite a number of towns in central Tigray, destroying many of the divisions of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and capturing, I might add, several batteries of artillery, tanks and hundreds of military vehicles, and use those newly acquired weaponry against the remaining divisions who were in flight towards Mekele. And so they were in hot pursuit. And then they encircled Mekele. The troops at that time, surrendered to the Tigrayan forces by the thousands with their equipment and everything.
And I saw an account that 7,000 prisoners were paraded.
Paraded in Mekele, yeah. The reason they were paraded in Mekele was this, because after they withdrew from Mekele, when the top officials and generals were evacuated from Mekele, the prime minister declared that there was a great victory for Ethiopian Defense Forces. They were able to withdraw at their own will with all their equipment and personnel intact.
Oh, this is what George Orwell used to call newspeak.
I mean, you wouldn't believe. And that's the narrative that's being actually used in Addis Ababa and many of the news outlets as aligned with the government. So it's to counter that, really, that they just had to show That's not true. They have to show the world. That's not the case.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so that's for what it is now. But you mentioned an update. There are significant number of Eritrean troops and troops from a militia from the Amhara region that are heavily fortified and in the northwestern Tigray. They are still there. And there's fighting going on there. And the
northwest or northeast?
Northwest. Okay. The northeast is liberated because that's the one that from on the way from Shire to Mekelle. So
and for listeners that are perhaps a little unfamiliar with the background history, Eritrea, of course, is a neighboring country.
Okay. We should mention that. By the way, we should mention that it is a foreign country that has been invited to attack, by the prime minister to attack his own people.
Right.
So that's also a first.
Or as you put it, to help him enforce police operation.
So
now let me ask you this.
Yeah.
This, professional armed forces, and Ethiopia, of course, has one of the most professional army on the African continent, with well-trained senior officers.
Yes.
And armies like this don't like a defeat. Are there going to be potentially some consequences politically for the prime minister?
There will be heavy consequences. There are several scenarios that commentators actually touch upon. First of all, a military with such a background, a very well-trained professional army that has been humiliated, is going to ask questions. What happened? First of all, the quality of the generals that Abiy Ahmed appointed may have something to do with it, because their only allegiance is the prime minister. And I would not be surprised if some junior officers up to the rank of colonel or even brigadier general would not be entertaining the idea of perhaps even staging a coup. I don't know, because these are some of the scenarios that some commentators are talking about. So there are going to be consequences.
So listeners, as we near the end of the show, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM radio, Black Star News Show. I'm your host, Milton Ali Mahdi. Before we wrap up, I want to remind you once again, we need your support. This is 100% listener-supported station, as you know. So be generous. Dig into your pocket or purse. And the number to call is 212-209-2950. Any contribution will be put to good use to bring you these types of programs. One of the few outlets in New York City, indeed in the U.S., where you can hear this kind of discussion focusing on events, issues, and news on the African continent. So please, 212-209-2950 is the number to call with your contributions to support this show and this station. You can also adopt one of the shows, including Black Star News Show, as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out of your debit or credit card on a monthly basis. And we will continue to bring you value on a weekly basis. Now, back to our guest, Dr. Mohamed Nur Hussein, to wrap it all up for today. But would that be a remarkable turn in fortunes? I mean, we are talking from the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago. We are talking from a police enforcement matter that started in November, and now we're in
8 months.
8 months later, we are talking the possibility of his grasp on power actually beginning to slip.
Yes.
Would that not be a stunning reversal of fortune?
It's a stunning reversal of fortune. I'm glad you mentioned the fact that he is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And that was given on the reconciliation that he effected with Eritrea. And now it turns out that peace, which has never been, by the way, the terms of which has never been made public, both in Ethiopia and Eritrea. And they have never faced any, press conference on this, no parliament. And nobody knows what that agreement was. But now it's becoming clear that the two leaders were really bound by their common hostility to the TPLF. And that peace was between them and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
See how they can coordinate their respective military into destroying the TPLF. So that seems to be the case. But the Nobel Prize was committee was hoodwinked into giving him for bringing peace into the country. What he has brought is far from peace. In fact, that whole area, the Horn of Africa, is in turmoil right now. Ethiopia certainly is at risk of disintegrating, and frankly, that's the biggest fear.
Biggest concern you have?
Yeah, many Ethiopians have, and also other countries that whose geostrategic interest may be affected by what happens, because it has implications for Somalia, for Sudan, and as far as the entire Red Sea basin. The Red Sea corridor. Yeah.
You're saying basically once you unleash military operations, the consequences are unpredictable domestically and even in regionally. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. So it is a huge problem. It's an important area for international peace and security, I think, and that has been disrupted by these military operations. I think one of the things, by the way, forget all the military aspect of it. I think what has happened is, the Eritrean forces and the Ethiopian forces really targeted specifically civilians. And right. It's been characterized by a series of massacres, the most horrific of which was revered Church of St. Mary's of Zion in Aksum, which is very, very sacred to many Orthodox Christians in Ethiopia. And also several other churches have been attacked. So the mosque, in fact, they were the first Muslim refugees came to Ethiopia. There is a mosque at that site that has been also aerial bombed. And big hall, gaping hall is left there. And they have been, and it's been looted, by the way. And many of these churches have been looted. So it's a cultural,
Attacks, Dr. Mohammed, were these attacks by Ethiopian soldiers or by Eritrean soldiers?
Eritrean primarily.
All right, so now listeners would not understand the motive and incentive behind that. So maybe you should tell them a little bit about the relations between the region of Tigray, part of Ethiopia, and its relations with Eritrea. Maybe that, just in a minute or so they have some context in terms of why they would be doing these destructive activities?
Well, more recent history is the close collaboration of TPLF and EPLF, Eritrean People's Liberation Front, during the war for independence by Eritrea. While the and they were coordinating their struggle together. In fact, you know, when the Mengistu's government actually was carrying out operation against the
Haile Mariam,
the president of Ethiopia at the time of the military government. TPLF actually came to the rescue of EPLF to relieve the siege that they were under. They were almost, you know, close to defeat. So that's one part of it. But that relationship has always been kind of contentious between the two parties. And then there came the war of that piece of land called Badime, in between Eritrea and Ethiopia, where a horrific war was fought in 1998 to 2000,
right?
Where you know the Prime Minister, the Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea, actually provoked the war, and Ethiopia had to defend itself, but eventually they you know. Eritrean troops had had a crushing defeat at the hands of the Ethiopian troops, right, who were led mostly by TPLF trained military officers. One of those officers, by the way, the commanding officer was General Zarkan, who is considered one of the best one of his time, you know, strategist. And he was responsible for
his name?
Zarkan. T-S-A-D-K-N, okay. General Zarkan. And it is him now that came from retirement. He had a business and all that. He left all that and went to join the Tigray Defense Forces and assume command of this disparate group of forces, some TPLF, some other new recruits and so on,
right,
and forced them into, you know, a major fighting force. And was responsible for the victory.
All right. So in terms of that history you just gave us, the Eritreans were inflicting sort of some revenge.
Absolutely, it was a revenge. Yeah.
For that war from the 90s.
Yes, it was a revenge. Well,
and a listener might say, well, if it's something in the 90s, why are they trying to seek revenge today in 2021? Because the same ruler from the 90s is still ruling Eritrea, correct?
The same ruler, the same person since independence, has no, a constitution was drawn, never implemented. He closed the parliament. He got rid of all his co-fellow freedom fighters, members of the Politburo of his party, the EPLF, have been either eliminated, jailed, or made to disappear. And many are, some are in exile.
So we're running out of time. We're running out of time, unfortunately. I think I have only time for two questions. Number one, and the more I listen, it seems to me that perhaps a bigger factor in this war is actually the leader of Eritrea, even more so than Abiy. It's beginning to sound that way to me.
Oh, yes. I think they complement each other. There is a big argument, by the way, who is manipulating whom. But there seems to be, yeah, the fact that Abiy Ahmed now withdrew Ethiopian forces from Tigray is telling Isaias, you're on your own, you know, now you know.
That's remarkable. You're on your own, but you're the one who invited him into the country.
Exactly. So.
But I have to ask you this question before we run out of time. What do you think, how do you think things will evolve? There was supposed to have been an election recently as well. What's going on with that? And, you know, what is the outcome? Do you really think that Abiy can survive as prime minister?
Well, that election was meant to really, he absolutely made sure that many of the credible opposition parties have either been barred from participating or their leaders imprisoned. There were some smaller parties that were able to participate. He wanted to make sure that his prosperity party comes out victorious.
So it was not really a free and fair election, is what you're saying?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And then there was several regions, including Tigray, but also vast regions of Oromia and some other parts in Somalia and so on, that were considered or Beni Shangur, rather, that were considered not safe and secure to hold elections. So, you know,
it doesn't sound like a real election at all, then.
No, because it was meant to be a coronation for him with a massive victory at the polls, but the Tigray Defense Forces completely upended his well orchestrated plan, because it was the end of the election.
Unforeseen. He certainly did not see the military reversal as a possibility.
But we're running out
of time. I only want to make this observation, and then I want you to make your reaction to it, and then also tell listeners how they can get in touch with you if they want to continue this conversation with you. And my observation is this. This, to me, is particularly disappointing, because Ethiopia was also becoming like a beacon of hope for the continent, with a growing economy, with a growing modern infrastructure, with growing industries. In other words, it was one of the better performing African countries compared to many other African countries. Ethiopia was very good. So to me, when I see this military conflict, it's very devastating for me personally. Maybe you can say something about that as well, and then tell listeners how they can get in touch with you.
I absolutely echo your sentiment. I think it's been the tragedy of our times as Africans, because Ethiopia was all the things that you say it was before it was plunged into this civil war, which that's what it is really, and at risk of disintegrating. I'm not so confident that it will, the center will hold. But
that would be very unfortunate. That would be very sad. Yeah. Now tell listeners how they can get in touch with you, please.
Well, you can get in touch with me through email, Mohammed, Mohammed, .Nurhussain, Nurhussain, @gmail.com.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We will have you back on this show to give us another update. Thank you so much, comrade. Listeners, remember to follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter, and also go to blackstarnews.com. Thank you so much, and thank you to our guest, Dr. Mohammed.
Thank you for having me.
WBAI listeners and staff, I'm Linda Perry, WBAI program director, with an important message. Please look for your ballot in your email or in your mail and vote on the ballot referendum. Vote no or vote yes, but please vote. All WBAI staff members should have already voted. It's your responsibility to vote in this election and to vote right now. Listeners, please vote as well. If you're undecided about how to vote on the proposed Pacifica Radio bylaw changes, then please tune in to WBAI on Saturday, July 3rd from 4 to 6 p.m. That's when proponents and opponents of the current bylaws proposal will debate, and you'll have the opportunity to call in with your questions. WBAI staff and listeners, you should have voted yes or no by July 7th, so that's just around the corner. This is to replace the Pacifica Foundation's bylaws with new bylaws proposed by a group of Pacifica members. If adopted, significant modifications will be made to the Foundation's governance structure. This would affect both the national and local station boards, including how you, as a listener sponsor, are represented and can participate. Please tune in on Saturday, July 3rd from 4 to 6 p.m. for a debate on the bylaws referendum, and please find your ballot and vote. For more info, please visit elections.pacifica.org or email our National Election Supervisor at nes@pacifica.org. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York, speaking truth to power for 61 years. Locally controlled WBAI, right in the center of the FM dial at 99.5 FM in New York. We stream at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Nicole Hannah-Jones, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and creator of the 1619 Project, has turned down a tenured position at the University of North Carolina and will be accepting a role at Howard University instead. The decision follows a massive controversy at the North Carolina school, which initially did not offer Hannah-Jones tenure before changing its position last week. She will now be taking on the role as inaugural night chair in race and journalism at Howard University, where she will also found a Center for Journalism and Democracy. Howard University also announced today that journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates would be joining the school's faculty. He will be a writer in residence at the university's College of Arts and Sciences and hold the Sterling Brown Chair in the English Department. Prosecutors in Washington, D.C. could be prevented from charging juvenile defendants as adults without a judge's permission if new legislation proposed by D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine is passed this year. The Redefinition of Child Amendment Act would eliminate the authority of the U.S. Attorney's Office to charge 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. Instead, prosecutors would be forced to argue cases in juvenile court for those defendants and would face a heavy burden of proof in convincing a judge to treat the teenager as an adult. From January 2013 to July 2020, over 250 juvenile defendants were sentenced as adults, according to Racine's office. In a statement, Racine said the new law would, quote, bring our justice system into alignment with long-established scientific research that tells us the brain is not fully developed at ages 16 and 17, and that young people, even those who commit serious crimes, can learn and evolve into upstanding and valuable members of our community. Councilmember Charles Allen, chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, said he agrees with the bill's concept, but that it's too soon to predict how the council will react. A statue of Martin Luther King was vandalized with a swastika and other Nazi symbols in Long Beach, California on Friday. The Long Beach Police Department said it was investigating the vandalism as a hate crime, but did not name any suspects as of Monday afternoon. The vandalism was denounced by local officials, including Mayor Robert Garcia, who called the graffiti, quote, horrific. Local groups rallied around the statue following the news of the vandalism, carrying signs reading, quote, "No room for hate in Long Beach," and "White silence is violence." Community activists in Memphis, Tennessee, and Northwest Mississippi are celebrating a grassroots victory on Saturday after two oil companies canceled plans to build a pipeline that would have run through wetlands in several low-income majority black neighborhoods. Valero and Plains All-American Pipeline said they will no longer pursue plans to build the pipeline, which would have been 49 miles long and linked two pipelines that transport crude oil to refineries on the Gulf Coast of Mexico. The two companies cited, quote, lower U.S.